day going. Zay, what'd you do today?
He said he was supposed to be working on his parents' house, but he didn't.
Yeah, you built a house today. You didn't?
No, my dad got sick. He might have COVID, so.
Oofta.
Wow.
Have you guys had to take the vaccine?
Actually, I was supposed to do it yesterday, but I slept through my alarm clock, so I'm just going to my mom's work and getting it done.
Rock on.
Oh, yeah. By the way, before we get too far, we got Devin joining us on this episode. Because we're diving deep into some crypto conversation, he's going to be our expert in the field and help us understand the topic once we get into that.
Hey, Devin.
So, yeah. Devin, what have you been up to?
Well, thank you for having me on. I have been watching a lot of Bitcoin. So, over this past weekend, it crashed from $40,000 down to $30,000.
My heart sank.
I've been reading tweets and Reddit comments of all kinds of people who've just been bailing on Bitcoin, while at the same time watching the statistics of people who only have like a little teeny bit of Bitcoin are selling it, but everyone who already has a whole ton of Bitcoin are buying it. So the retailers are selling to the whales, and now it's creeping back up. We're back up to 37,600.
I'm really excited.
Doesn't like having all those people sell off their Bitcoin cause it to drop even further?
Yeah, right. So it's a market's pretty simple. If you have more sellers than buyers, the price goes down. But what we saw was a lot of people had borrowed money to buy Bitcoin. And as the price dropped a little bit, a lot of the exchanges automatically sold that Bitcoin to collect the borrowed money. And so a lot of these, what we call long positions, were automatically liquidated. So you had some people that were selling just because they were going to sell. You know, who knows who they were. But then a ton of other people had their Bitcoin automatically sold. And the price dropped.
Oh, stop loss.
Super fast. No. Stop loss is different.
Well, it's close enough. Anyways, this is the beginner's guide to Bitcoin, and we are already getting too deep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isaiah, you had something.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm pretty excited because I know nothing about Bitcoin at all. Adam's talked about it a little bit, but...
Yeah, I have some basic knowledge.
Never done any research on it. I'm not quite sure how it all works.
Rock on. Well, I'll put you guys in the driver's seat, and I'm just here as a resource for wherever you'd like to go.
Beautiful. And speaking of Adam, how was your day?
It was good.
Week.
Just month. Worked all day, and then come here.
Why do I even ask you? That's always your answer. I don't
do anything
it's like,
else.
Cool. God, yeah, but work is fun, right? You love your job. Life is great.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced. Kick us off.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Unsolved Dimension. I'm one of your hosts today, Adam, and alongside me is Isaiah.
Hey, guys, what's going on?
And Jamin.
We're making it rain with those Bitcoin bits.
And our special guest today, Devin.
Howdy.
All right. So today, we're looking at the root of all evil, money. Wars have been fought for gold, men will murder for a few bucks, and CEOs will lie for a little bonus. Greed has plagued this world and destroyed prospering societies. No matter how much you have, everyone seems to always want more. Is it possible that we're about to enter a new age of currency? The age of crypto? Let's start with one of the biggest power grabs in history. It was when the US became one of the most powerful countries in the world, and there's a good argument to be made that their dominance is coming to an end.
I got a question, Jamin.
All right.
We haven't even started yet.
I know. I'm curious. Yes.
I want to know your guys' opinion. Do you guys still think we're one of the most powerful countries?
I think we got one of the loudest voices and strongest militaries. So that's power, right?
Yeah.
Educationally?
Not doing great in that one.
That is true. It's a lot of factors.
When it comes to college, our education's pretty solid. People come here to want to learn. Below college, a little bit of a different story. And when it comes to money, we are still in charge, but that could all be about to change. So,
All right.
I'm going to throw us into the deep end just by discussing a little bit why the U.S. is the leader in the global currency market era world. So we're going to start off in 1914, where the first U.S. dollar was printed, and you might have heard the term greenback. So this is where people were literally able to bring their money or bring their silver in and have it stamped and turn into silver dollars, or they can turn in gold or other
precious metals.
And that led to the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank on December 23rd, 1913. Then this is going to take us into the next generation, when things started to change a little bit. During World War II, the Allied countries were allowed to pay for supplies and support from the U.S. using gold. This meant that by the end of the war, the U.S. had the largest gold supply in the world. In 1944, in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, 44 countries came together at the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference to discuss the possibility of creating a global currency and trade system. They agreed to create a global reserve and bank that would help support countries that were ravaged by the war. It would utilize a single currency to help simplify global trade. The U.S. dollar was chosen as the global currency they would use because it was the most stable form of money in circulation thanks to the massive amount of gold the U.S. had in its reserve. War is the issue with a lot of things, I'm coming to realize as we go through different parts of history.
So, you guys remember from history class that the United States tried to stay out of World War II until Pearl Harbor, and then it was game on.
They started it.
Yeah. What we don't really see is behind the scenes, all of the other countries who were engaged in the war before us, they ran out of money, and they started borrowing from us, the United States. And so even before we entered the war, we were a huge manufacturing base for military equipment and food supplies. So we were sending lots of civilian goods over to countries that were engaged in the war because their own capacity to produce those goods was impaired. And over that time, we built up quite a stockpile of money, and that money being gold at the time. And so after the war, we had this huge problem that all of these countries who had been fighting were in debt to the United States, most of them. And we had a second problem that in the past, the British had been the empire of the world. And so countries around the world had used the British pound to conduct international trade. So, you know, in one country you have a currency, in another country you have a different currency. But when they wanted to do business with one another, they would use the British currency, the pound. But now that was worthless because Great Britain had spent way, way more money than they had. And so the dollar, backed by gold, was chosen to be the world reserve currency. It was agreed that all other financial economies would be built on top of the dollar, and therefore international trade would be conducted in dollars. And it basically still is today. Mostly. Countries are allowed to use other currencies, but it's still the dollar dominates international trade right now.
I can't believe that everyone was so cool with just America taking over. Like, yep, don't worry, guys. We'll make the gold and give you guys the dollars and it'll all work out just fine.
Mainly because we were one of the countries still backing our currency by gold. So they thought our dollar backing theirs would be more stable than just some random currency that's not backed by gold.
Seems smart. Seems like a wise decision. Well, I mean, it'd be stupid if we ever decided to change that, right? So Adam, fill us in a little bit more on how this gold standard continued to prosper in our banks and we just never left it. So every single dollar is worth that much in gold to this day, right? That's how it still works?
Right. No. So the dollar, as you probably know, was originally backed by gold, and it was kind of the classic gold standard, which meant that any currency backed by gold was able to be redeemed the paper value amount for the same amount in gold. This was kind of easier just so you don't have to carry around all these metal coins and have a huge purse full of coins. And so in 1834, the U.S. fixed the price of gold at $20.67 an ounce, and it stayed at this price until 1933. World War I started, the U.S. and other countries suspended their gold standard so they could print more money and pay for the war. And this is when countries saw you didn't really need to tie the paper currency to gold. So the gold exchange standard came about, where countries could hold in their reserves gold, dollars, or pounds, except for the U.S. and U.K., who had to have gold or silver. So in 1931, the UK abandoned the gold standard, and the US was the only one left.
They needed to spend way more money than they had.
And around this same time in 1933, FDR made some changes that essentially took us off the classic gold standard even more. Congress made it so that creditors couldn't demand to be paid in gold anymore. And FDR forbid banks from paying out gold or exporting it. And he ordered any gold coins or certificates over $100 to be turned in for paper money at the same set price of $20.67. So the government collected around 300 million in gold coins and around 470 million of gold certificates. But would it be the U.S. government if they didn't screw the people over? Because in 1934, they increased the price of gold to $35 per ounce.
Wait, but you said it was $20.67.
Pretty big jump.
Hey, I want my gold back.
I love gold.
Right? When I'm buying gold from you, I want it nice and cheap. But once I have it, I want the price to go up.
And it's just convenient that they get to set the price.
Our country's just a big old pawn shop, isn't it?
Best I can do is $1.
Best I can do is $35.
So they essentially increased their reserve by 69% with this increase in price per ounce. They even made it illegal for private citizens to own gold with the 1934 Gold Reserve Act, unless you had a license. So jump ahead 30 years, and in 1960, the U.S. had $19.4 billion in gold reserves. But the gold reserves continued to decline because of stagflation caused by Nixon's economic policies. And if you don't know what stagflation is, it's basically when inflation is high and unemployment is high and economic growth is low. And the problem with the stagflation is if you make regulations to help inflation, it's going to cause unemployment to go even higher, or just different situations that it's pretty hard to get out of.
I believe that.
So around this time, the Soviet Union was kind of big in the oil game, and just hearing all this caused them to deposit their dollar reserves into European banks so that the U.S. would not seize their accounts during the Cold War, because they thought they might to use it as a tactic during the Cold War. And these became known as euro dollars. Banks all over were redeeming their dollar reserves for gold, which made the U.S. gold reserves go down. Other countries were worried that the U.S. would no longer back up the dollar on gold.
At about this time, world leaders were getting suspicious that the United States was abusing their position as the arbiter of the world's reserve currency, so that they're suspicious that the United States can print for themselves tons of dollars, as many dollars as they need, which puts everyone else at a disadvantage who has to play by the rules.
Us Americans? We would never! How dare you, sir?
We would. And we did.
And we still are.
So this was, it was a rumor, and then eventually France called America's bluff and sent a warship to New York Harbor with orders to redeem some of the paper dollars for gold. I don't know the quantity, but it was basically at that point that Nixon went on TV and said that he is discontinuing the convertibility of the dollar into gold. This is where, to read the history and then to read what the government actually said about it, you get two very different stories, where you have the world distrusting that the United States is playing fair, but then you have Nixon going on TV and telling the American people that there are foreign speculators trying to take down the American economy. Because that's exactly what would happen. The speculation is that America's cheating. And if that was ever exposed, it was going to be a really bad deal. And so you kind of see this little economic warfare going on. And it's the weirdest thing in the world that we smoothly transitioned from a gold-backed dollar to a nothing-backed dollar. Like, the world kept turning.
It weird. Isaiah's a big Nixon fan, so, I mean, he was all for this.
Yeah.
He had some good qualities and some bad.
I've heard you say that about Nixon about 20 times now.
But yeah, what Devin was talking about with Nixon was on August 15th, 1971, he officially declared that the U.S. would no longer redeem the currency for gold. So, I mean, this caused some problems like inflation, and a lot of people just thought that we should go back to the gold standard and we were just going to crash and burn, because between 1880 and 1914, when we were on the classic gold standard, inflation only averaged 0.1% per year, which is
That's pretty good. Yeah.
It's especially when it gets really high here that people still think we should go back to a gold standard, because 5% inflation is pretty big.
Not great. I don't think it's even possible at this point to go back to a gold standard. We don't have enough gold.
So there's something about going back to the gold standard. Like Adam said, like, a lot of people want to do it, but it's not going to work. And there's a really important thing about why that wouldn't work. If, let's just say, we were going to reinstitute gold and silver as our only currency for economic trade. The trouble is the world is so interconnected and money moves so quickly that there's no way we could do that and actually hand around gold and silver coins. We would have to trust a third party to hang on to those gold and silver coins. And over and over and over again throughout our history, like we've been talking about, we see that those third parties, that central entity that we have to trust to hold the gold and silver coins, they always get corrupted. Every time. No exceptions. And so I don't think it's really possible to go back to a gold standard. And the only, and that's where the alternative, there's a book out there called The Bitcoin Standard, where we get all of the advantages of gold without any of the central authorities of gold. Adam's cheering.
Adam, have you read it or something?
No, but okay. Go Bitcoin.
Yeah. Like, that's what it's for. That's literally why it was invented, because we can't, gold won't work as much. I've got a lot of boomers on YouTube that I follow that are gold bugs. They love gold. They've been investing in it for decades. And I'm listening to the smartest financial guys that I know, and they're just like, it won't work. We need, if we go to gold, we need a centralized authority. And history shows us that every time it doesn't work. Every single time.
So you're saying when you go back to gold, are you saying like physical gold? Are we talking physical gold?
No, the color.
Okay. All right. That makes more sense. I didn't know. Because you're investing in gold. Okay. It's coming together now.
Yeah, wheels so it's are like turning. Physical gold that they have to hold on to that is represented by a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you that'd have be, a piece of paper that's the same value as a certain amount of gold.
So what happens to strip clubs when you go back to gold? Do you...
I think the gals have to wear Kevlar.
They're just up there in armor. You just chuck gold at them.
Chucking Isaiah, you would still have a dollar bill.
You'd still have... Okay.
It's just backed by gold.
You take a pellet gun with little gold BBs.
So like we said before, somebody is holding the actual gold itself, and the people have a piece of paper that represents the value of a certain amount of gold.
Okay, so they're not carrying around gold nuggets around and stuff. No. It's okay.
Well,
that'd be hilarious though.
Your question is exactly the point, that it's so impractical that if we did go back to the gold standard, we would eventually end up with someone holding on to it in a vault while the rest of us used paper out in the economy.
Okay. Or they do what the US did and just say that they have it in the vault. And then when someone comes to actually get it out of the vault, they're like, oh, about that.
We were robbed.
Whoops. We were robbed.
From the Federal Reserve, yeah. One of the hardest banks to even get in.
All right. So now that we've hit the, we're off the gold standard, we've started to see the decline in value. And I think Adam's going to help us dive into just how dramatic that's been. Well, you wrote the section.
I didn't write this.
Oh, Devin, did you write that?
I wrote that. So there's a lot of tricks of terminology that the government has pulled on us in the last 40 to 50 years when they talk about inflation. Because it'd be a really bad deal if you're the United States government for your people to think that the things that you're doing are making their lives more expensive. That'd be a really unpopular idea to have out there. And so the government has this target called inflation that they're like, we are looking for a 2% targeted inflation. And I think it's really important to talk about, one, what inflation is, and two, why 2% is the target. And so first, I want to talk about what inflation is. So inflation used to mean the expansion of the money supply, the monetary supply. So if you think about, like, if all of the money supply is a balloon, right? You got air in it, certain amount of air, and you can inflate it by blowing more air into the balloon, and it gets bigger. That's a really silly example. But similarly, that inflating the money supply had nothing to do with the price of anything. Inflation meant how many units of currency are flowing around in the economy. That used to be equal to how many ounces of gold are flowing around in the economy. And the amount of gold moving around the economy used to expand by 2% per year on average. And the reason, like, who picked that number? You could say, like, well, God did, because that's the fastest we could dig up new gold.
I was wondering, so that's literally 2%. We find 2% goal per year. So the economy grows by that.
Yeah, the amount that we find every year comes to about 2% addition each year in gold. But the main point underneath it is that that 2% number was a very natural number. When we were on a gold standard, that number worked really well. The economy grew really well, the money was trusted, and it seemed to be a good deal. And so, now that the government is printing money, they did something where they changed the definition of inflation. It used to be that rising prices in the grocery store, those were the result of inflation. They were a symptom of inflation. And then at some point, our government started telling us that inflation is the rising prices. And so they can print as much money as they like. And if we don't see prices going up, well, no harm, no foul. Everything's okay. But here's what they do. They do, over the years, they change how they calculate inflation. And so one of the big things that's in their inflation bucket, they have a little basket of things they measure every year, which they're like, did the price of this go up? That was inflation. Did the price of this change? That's inflation. There are things included and things that are excluded. The things that are included, things like TVs. Apparently, Netflix subscription cost is included in that evaluation. They things that aren't. What was that?
I was going to say they include TVs because they go down in price.
Right. How convenient. They don't include college tuition. Has anyone here tried to go to college?
Yep. And
too expensive for my taste.
I've heard yeah. numbers that it's like from when our parents were in college that it's like around, I mean, like hundreds of percent more expensive
yeah.
than when we went or than
yeah.
they went to college.
If you look at the percentage changes in college tuition versus wages, college tuition has inflated so much by their definition of inflation that it used to be you could work a summer job and pay your tuition. Like, you work a summer job, pay for your school during the school year. That's impossible now. Now, I know my friends are spending 10, 20 years to pay off their college tuition. And a lot of them, I know a number of them, who are banking on being forgiven of their loan. So they're just paying the interest until the government comes in to forgive the principal. That's nuts. And the government's here to tell us that there's only 2% inflation. Healthcare costs as well.
Ooh.
Right? Someone gets seriously ill. If they don't have rock solid insurance, they're putting together a GoFundMe, and if they don't get enough money, like, people die because they can't afford healthcare. And healthcare has seen inflation way higher than 2%. The way that the government calculates inflation, they don't include a lot of the food that you and I eat. They don't include energy costs. Like, who on earth lives their life and doesn't buy gasoline? Do you know anyone that their life is not affected by that? No. So as soon as you start to include all of those things, oh, housing as well. Housing. Have you noticed housing prices? Have you noticed rent prices the last like 5 years? Tell me, does it 2% inflation make sense of all that? No, not at all.
I'm pretty sure it went up about 7 to 8%. Because of taxes, my landlord said last year. They're like, yep, it's just the average increase. It was between 8 to 13%. We're like,
that's why you.
What do you
why
mean?
Why you re-sign your lease?
We did re-sign it. We didn't want to move. Then we got him signing us for a month-to-month deal, and it's weird. He never increased the price because we could suddenly back out any month that we wanted to.
Interesting.
Well, that's stupid. My landlord, if I went month, even though in the contract it says after a year it goes month to month, nowhere in there does it say your price increases. But he said it was going to increase like $300 a month, and I was like,
because of
aren't
tax
you a lawyer
law or something?
Yeah, I could have definitely fought it, but we were like, we're going to stay here for a year anyway, so just
pick your battle.
I could have easily, I mean, it was literally in the contract. There's nothing in the contract.
So on inflation, I want to say one last point on inflation. There's a lot of people that have been watching this and just like, this is garbage. These calculations that the government handing out, they're not real. So there's a website called the Chapwood Index. That's C-H-A-P-W-O-O-D, Chapwood Index. You Google that. These guys, just some private people, took it into their own hands. They're like, we're going to go in every major city in the United States and find out how much are prices actually changing for everyone. And they started doing this in 2017, and they found that inflation actually ranges from 8% to 12%, depending on the city you're in, when the government is telling us it's 2%.
That's so literally the percentage I said my rent increased at the end of the year.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, even I just looked it up, and even Wichita's 7 to 8, like.
Yeah, and that's like one of the lowest. It's one of the lowest inflation rates in the United States is in Wichita, Kansas.
Come to Wichita if you want to get your value.
Well, be careful, because too many people come down there and it's going to turn around.
Stay out! This is our county!
Turn into California.
Cities want to grow, but it also causes a lot of other issues.
So I wanted to talk about
this. We don't
want
your kind!
Sorry, go on.
I wanted to kind of paint a picture of what this really means. Because, I mean, it's one thing to see the number on a page, and it's another to really feel what that actually means for you and me. So imagine you have, I don't know, $10,000, and you're going to open a bank account, a savings account for the next 30 years. You've got one savings account that offers you 2% interest, and one savings account that offers you 10% interest. Which one are you going to park your money in?
10%, but I want to find that one.
I know. Well, I'll show you. I'll show you some places to earn 10% interest. But yeah, it's a no-brainer. We all know, like, I'm going to get so much wealthier parking my money with 10% interest. It's just going to compound. It's going to be fantastic. So here's the deal is, the reality is our money's been losing purchasing power. So if you take that chart you're imagining of your 10% interest growth year over year and turn it upside down, that's the purchasing power of the dollar draining away year over year. So if you started saving, 20 years ago, that the initial money that you put in, if it was not earning 10% or more, it has lost a ton of value. So I know I watch YouTube videos of investment advice all the time. And one of the guys I watch is like, in telling people to invest in stocks and bonds. And he's like, you want to look for a 5% return every year on your investments. I'm like, 5%, that's half. That's losing half of my value. Like 5% is actually a negative 5%. If inflation is 10% and I'm only earning 5%, then I'm actually losing 5%. Now try to retire on that.
Yeah, that's why retirement, you keep needing more and more to be comfortable. And that's why they always say a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow.
Yep.
You better spend it. Everybody spend all their money right now.
Well, and that's, we might get in this later, but.
Join our Patreon.
All right.
We don't have that.
Our money, I believe, influences how we behave. And I don't think anyone has to actively tell us to spend our money today instead of saving it. I think that over the years, you give it, let's say you need 5 years of engaging in the economy, it becomes intuitive that your money is losing value every day. And so you should buy something, that it's a bad idea to hang on to cash. And the government came out and told us, you know, they tell us to save. The banks want you to save. The active verbiage is to save, but the actual experience teaches us, I think at a very subconscious level, that you want to spend the money. And then we have Dave Ramsey goes on the radio and shouts, "Oh, stupid millennials are spending all their money, blah, 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 blah." It's like, well, Dave, what you don't understand is that inflation has been 5 times worse than you've been telling us it is. And all of us have intuitively learned to spend our money. Had we grown up when your grandma did, when inflation was actually 2% and I could earn an interest rate at a bank account of like 6 to 10%, it'd be intuitive to save. I would have the experience of every dollar that I saved grew in value over time. And I would be such a good saver. I would save like crazy. Wouldn't have to think about it. But that's not what my money taught me. My money taught me that it's worthless and I need to spend it.
I'm not gonna lie, that has always been weird, seeing like just the concept of, well, if I put my money in this bank and it just sits there, it'll make more money. It's like, yeah, okay, that, in theory, and everywhere that I've heard, that's how it should work, but that's not, why would they do that? Why would they give me more money for my money?
Technically, it does make more money.
Well, just
but
not
it's
at the
not
rate
worth
to keep up with
the
inflation.
Same amount.
Well, this is, so there's some organizations in the crypto space that are really like, and part of what they're doing is, like, they are making money just like a bank is making money. Like, a bank is making good money with the money you put with them. they're getting a good return. Like, look at the APR on your credit card. And how many people are carrying a balance on their credit card? The 20%. Banks, right, banks are making 20%. The money that you're swiping, when you swipe your credit card, you're spending money from some depositor at that bank. And now you owe back that money plus 18% if you carry that balance for a year. The bank is making all that money. They're just not sharing it with their depositors. I mean, you want to see how profitable a bank is? Look at their stock. They have good dividends, a lot of them.
Okay, so now that we have a good understanding of how hard and how fast the US dollar is crashing and just the travesty that is the US economy and how it's kind of destined to doom in the near future, doesn't that kind of open the door for other countries to make a power play and try to take over as the global currency?
Yeah, it does, but it's also, it's a big job that the United States has. So we always talk about, when we talk about the United States on the world stage, that we're a consumer of goods. We ship jobs overseas. We buy stuff that's manufactured overseas. I mean, I know a number of companies that they hire software developers overseas instead of hiring Americans.
Yeah. Like, right? In India or, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but what we don't realize is we're actually exporting a product too. Like, so, you know, Malaysia's exporting toys for everyone to buy at Christmas time that they're manufacturing. The United States is exporting dollars. Because the United States dollar is the world reserve currency, all of these other countries need dollars to conduct international business. And the best way to acquire those dollars is to sell something to Americans. And so we get all this stuff for super cheap. That the fact that we can get things super cheaply from overseas is because those countries are competing for our business because our money is so valuable. But that could be changing because we're further abusing our power of the purse by printing and printing and printing. $3 trillion? It's crazy. Last March, 2020, we printed for ourselves $3 trillion, like in a weekend or whatever.
We needed it. I'm getting the vibe that we're like a mob boss and these people are coming to us needing help and we're like, okay, well, what are you going to do for me?
You're starting to
what
get it.
What are you going to give
that's
me?
That's why I feel like the national debt, they always talk about how it keeps getting bigger and bigger, but I'm like, it's just like fake. Like,
right.
Once it passed, I think, 18 to 15 billion or trillion, I was like, trillion. It doesn't even matter. It's just a fake number at this point. It doesn't matter.
So here's what's nuts. About that time when we printed for ourselves all that bailout money, 14 or 15 other countries from Africa, the Middle East, and parts of Europe, they went crawling to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, begging, just all 14 of these countries, begging for $1.5 trillion total together. So they're begging for that money. And we just printed it at the drop of a hat. Like, does that seem a little bit unfair? Wow. How do you think the rest of the world feels about that?
I like it. Sounds fair to me. As an American, fully support.
Right. And so here's something that's been really interesting. And there's a guy on YouTube, George Gammon, who really unpacked this super well in a recent YouTube video. So one of the big people we export to, we import stuff from China. And when we do that, we are exporting dollars to China. Well, China doesn't just sit on these dollars. They go and they loan them to all of these other countries throughout Africa and Eastern Europe and other parts of Asia to build what they call the One Road Initiative. What's the official name, Jamin? I wrote it there. One Belt and Road
Initiative.
Belt and Road, yeah.
Like, Belt and I don't Road know. Why are you asking me?
I wrote it in the notes and I can't see them.
Oh, yeah. Belt and Road Initiative.
Right. Initiative. So you remember one of the reasons, like if you remember after World War II, we had huge infrastructure projects here in the United States and got like the international highway system. So think of it's that kind of infrastructure projects all over Asia, Europe, and into Africa. And China is, when all the dollars that we're exporting to China, that's what they're using them for. They're making investments in their own economic future like crazy. And so they are doing this, one, just building infrastructure that they can have a thriving economy around. But two, they're kind of, it's a little dirty that they are saying, we will loan you the money. So they'll go to some country and they'll say, we'll loan you the dollars that we just got from America. We're going to loan you money to hire us to come build you a bunch of highways and stuff and power grid and other infrastructure things that they need. And so, yeah, if you're, I don't have any countries offhand, but there's some Eastern African countries where they get all this cool new infrastructure, but now they owe China millions of dollars, hundreds of millions, something crazy, maybe billions of dollars. I haven't looked at the numbers themselves. And so that's where, if the currency that we were all using internationally starts to falter, which it is, like I've listened to some researchers that think we're past the point of no return for the dollar. Like, it's over and we're just trying to figure out what to do now. China's ready to introduce an alternative, probably backed by gold, probably digital, that they can immediately require all these countries that owe them money to start using for commerce, because they created all these entanglements.
Oh my gosh.
And so that's where...
Yeah.
Right. It's genius. Absolutely brilliant. Very brilliant. And here in America, I feel like we're so short-sighted. We just yell at the Chinese Communist Party for printing money and overspending, but it's the pot calling the kettle black. We're printing money too. We're just not investing it wisely like they are. They're just trying to make a huge economic power grab. So it's going to be a really interesting decade that we're heading into.
We don't need to have any big services that we can provide other countries with other than our military as security guards.
That's kind of... Okay.
Our military is all over the place.
I don't know if you should include
that. What? How controversial is that? I don't care. I'm adding it. I said it. It's the truth. We're just sending our people out there and helping out with other wars that we don't have anything to do with. So legitimately, we are battling with China. Who is owed more money, America or China? And then those countries kind of owe their allegiance to that country.
Right. Right. So you at least owe an economic. You have a debt that you actually have to pay. And so that's kind of whoever ends up controlling the money ends up controlling the world, which is why the United States has had such influence for so long. It's not because we're, you know, more morally righteous than all these other countries. As I've grown up with that ever since 9/11, that being just proclaimed that we need to go bomb all the Middle Eastern countries because of our moral righteousness and blah, 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 blah. We need to bring them freedom. You dig in a little bit and you're like, nope, I don't think we're actually... I mean, maybe we have a few technological benefits, but there's a lot of things that are very, I think that's gaslighting.
And with the debt, don't we owe the same countries that owe us money also? How does that work?
Yeah.
Like, do they just not try to collect on it?
We owe China a lot.
Right.
Or like cancel it since they both...
Have you ever refinanced a house?
No.
Or have you ever... Like the process of refinancing.
I mean, I know how it works, okay. But
no, just go with that. How do you do okay. that?
When you and I buy a house, the bank issues a piece of paper called a mortgage that specifies how much money we owe. And that mortgage, one bank might sell it to another bank, and the price they're going to pay from bank to bank is the value that you and I would pay over the course of 30 years. So over the course of time, you pay down some of that mortgage. And then you want to refinance. And when you refinance, what you're doing is the bank is loaning you enough money, again, to purchase, like to buy out the remaining value of the mortgage. And then that old mortgage gets snuffed out by the new one. Now you have a new debt, new totals, new terms, etc. And that's basically what the United States does with our treasury bonds, where we have, when the United States needs to borrow money, they're not making a mortgage, they're issuing a treasury bond. And people buy that. Private banks here in the United States buy it. Other countries can buy it. The Federal Reserve ends up buying most of them now. Almost all of them just go straight. The Fed buys them all. But when it comes time to pay that off, instead of actually paying back in cash, we are just borrowing again to basically refinance the debt and extend it another number of years over and over and over. You know, I can't for the life of me understand why that works, why everyone figured that would be fine. But we're getting to the point now where countries, China, one of the big ones, countries are not repurchasing the treasury bonds. So like our debt only works if people are willing to buy them, right? If actual productive capacity in another country is spent with us in the United States in terms of buying these bonds. But what we're seeing now is all these other countries are trying to get rid of the bonds. They're trying to very quietly and one at a time and patiently sell them off over the course of years because they don't think America's ever going to actually pay this back. So I don't want to hold on to this. But at the same time, if I sell them off too quickly, I might trigger an avalanche and everyone's going to sell them. And then I might not be able to sell mine before they're worthless and nobody's willing to buy them. But there's one entity buying all of the treasury bonds every time we refinance our own debt, and that's the Federal Reserve. I mean, it's a little shady how they end up in their hands, but basically it creates this feedback loop where the government needs to borrow money and the Federal Reserve poofs money into existence and buys that debt. We turns out, we can't pay that debt that we borrowed again. No worries, Federal Reserve, poof, money into existence, buys that debt too. And they call this
money.
They call
love
it
money.
Yeah. On the news, you hear this called monetizing the debt. They're monetizing the debt. It's like, what? Yeah. What does that even mean? Nothing.
It's just making up terms.
And to, it's like,
it's excuses now. It's great.
Economics becomes this game that we're playing with ourselves. Yeah. Like other countries are like, yeah, you guys can have your own money, but there's coming, we're getting closer to a day where other countries are going to be like, we don't want it anymore. We're going to figure out something else.
Yeah, it's gonna bite us in the ass at some point.
Yeah. Well, I think that our generation is going to be the last one to see the dollar as the world's dominant currency on a global scale. I don't know what the future's exactly going to look like, but one thing I'm sure of is that the government's going to keep printing money and the world's going to stop accepting it at some point. So this is a worldwide problem. It became pretty clear that governments were not going to fix it. And so the hackers and the cypherpunks got together and they invented Bitcoin.
And Bitcoin is what we're going to dive into next week in our part two, when we actually look at what could be the lifeline for the economy.
So if you want to follow us on social media, you can find us at The Unsolved Dimension on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to give us a DM or just a comment asking a question and give us some suggestions or a question on any previous episode you've heard, feel free to.
And our direct line, if you want to send us an email for any feedback, future episode ideas, or questions, is theunsolveddimension@gmail.com.
And then if you guys want to get on Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a comment, we will give you guys a little shout out on our next episode.
And if you want to learn more from Devin and his infinite knowledge on crypto and just the economy as we know it, you can learn more over at finalsigma.io. That's finalsigma.io.
So you started your own, is it like a consulting firm?
Yeah. So it was initially intended to be like one-on-one consulting for, I think, of folks like my dad who they see there's a ton of value in the world of crypto, but it's super confusing because it's all these new technical paradigms that he didn't grow up with that are all just emerging right now. And so the idea was, if there's anybody out there who has, they're looking at some technology and they've got some specific questions around it, that I would kind of become their personal shopper of information on those subjects that are on their mind. So like a good question might be like, hey, what is Filecoin? What is the system that's behind it? And like, why would someone buy that? I don't understand what that is. And then what my service for them, first, quote, you know, kind of do a little preliminary research and quote them like, hey, here's what I think based on the time and material to get you some really good answers. Here's a price and give me about a week and I'm come back and do a presentation to really equip you with some knowledge. And then we'll gather together. And I want to walk through who started Filecoin, for example. what is the underlying technology? In this case, it's a big data storage solution to compete with Amazon. Really walk through how it works, why it's valuable, what the strengths are, what the weaknesses are. To kind of cut through what the rumors are on the internet, there's a lot of morons trading cryptocurrencies and try to get to the real value propositions. Because for some people, they want to just buy some of these coins and make some money off of them. But there's some others that like you can build a whole business on top of. Like you can ditch. What if you could ditch all those Google services for something that was decentralized, like that Google couldn't ban you from? Would that be interesting to you? And I think there's a lot of people like, yeah, you mean I can have a 100% online business like I have today and not be beholden to Google or Amazon or any of these other guys? And like, yeah, there's going on right now. It's in the world of crypto is the steering wheel.
All right.
So you can catch us next time on The Unsolved
Dimension. The Unsolved Dimension.
I love gold.
Oh, I love Bitcoin more. And we'll see you on part two.
Part two.
Peace.